Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, I'll be interviewing Kelly Copeland of Nayrol, Ohio, about recent pro-choice victories in her state. ACOG comes out in support of over-the-counter birth control pills, and Parks and Recreation makes fun of abstinence-only education. RH Reality Check's own Jody Jacobson was on Huffington Post's live show to discuss why 200 million women around the world can't get the contraception they want and need.
You know, since the 70s, basically contraception has been recognized by the United Nations as a basic human right, and this was reaffirmed again in the 1990s at the International Conference on Population and Development. So it's really nothing new. It may have become a new thing in the context of the U.S. Discussion because of all of the controversy, the creative controversy around contraception. I don't think it cheapens the phrase human rights. In fact, I think it gives a greater dimension to what human rights mean.
It's about a half-hour video, and I highly recommend checking it out. The American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, known as ACOG, broke some interesting ground late November by announcing their support for over-the-counter sales of oral contraception. Not just emergency contraception, but the good old-fashioned birth control pill. ACOG is basically the gynecologist version of the American Medical Association, so their policies and positions matter quite a bit, usually, though I suspect less than they should in this case. Here's Vice President of Practice Activities, Gerald Joseph, making the announcement.
The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists today recommends that oral contraceptives be able to be administered to patients over the counter without a prescription. We have taken this step because of the unintended pregnancy rate in the United States. Over the past 20 years, the unintended pregnancy rate in our country has hovered around 50%. And in all those years, we've done very little to improve that statistic. We are in hopes that the ability for women to seek and get oral contraceptives without a prescription will enhance access to birth control pills, which is today the leading reversible form of contraception for women. And in so doing, it will hopefully reverse or at least decrease the unintended pregnancy rate in this country.
One thing a lot of Americans don't know is that over-the-counter birth control pills are hardly an anomaly or a strange idea. Many countries already have this as a policy, including Mexico. In fact, Mexico's policy on this is one of the reasons that there's been more interest in moving towards this system in the U.S. A recent research study done in El Paso compared two groups of women, those who got the pill at pharmacies in Juarez and those who got their pills at public clinics in El Paso, and found that the women who went to pharmacies in Juarez to get over-the-counter birth control pills were better at using contraception. The reason is almost surely because it's more convenient. Drugstores have better hours and are often more accessible. Plus, you can buy multiple packets at the same time instead of having to get them one at a time, which is often how it goes at public clinics. Dr. Joseph discussed this aspect of this in the announcement.
One of the problems with oral contraceptives is the dropout rate. And we feel that being able to access oral contraceptives without a prescription will greatly improve this access rate and enhance utilization. Studies have shown that when women are able to get multiple monthly packs of birth control pills, they are much more likely to remain on the birth control pills and not discontinue their use.
One concern that was raised in multiple corners was the cost issue. Right now, prescription birth control is available to most women with health insurance without a copay, and next year it will be available to all insured women. But ACOG addressed this issue in the report. This recommendation isn't meant to replace prescription birth control pills at all. The assumption is most women will still go through their doctors, especially since they're already getting well woman checkups. But for women who can't get the pills through a doctor, this could help. Additionally, for women that are on prescription pills, having over-the-counter access could also help a lot. If you're traveling and forget your pills, for instance, you could buy some replacements. or if it slipped your mind to make a doctor's appointment and now your prescription has run out, or if you're changing doctors or jobs or moving or any of the other life disruptions that can make it harder to keep up with the prescription, and which we know are linked with increased rates of unwanted pregnancy. The other concern raised was, of course, safety. But the pill is actually quite safe.
Gynecologist Dan Grossman's research led to today's recommendation that oral contraceptives be made available over the counter to reduce the risk of unwanted pregnancies.
We have over 50 years of experience with oral contraceptives now, and it's one of the best studied medications that's around. So we know it's incredibly safe.
This is a reality that often gets lost in the shuffle because there is a lot more attention paid to the negative side effects that some experience on the pill than on almost any other medication, even though it's statistically a very safe drug. But not only should its safety be compared to other, more dangerous drugs that are sold over the counter, but also to the condition that the pill prevents, that is, unwanted pregnancy.
And although no drug is perfectly safe, even aspirin has its side effects, that oral contraceptives are a relatively safe drug. The benefits far outweigh the risk, especially when you compare the risks of the biggest problem with oral contraceptives, that is thromboembolism, blood clots, in pregnancy and even in the postpartum period are much greater than they are on oral contraceptives. So again, we feel that the safety of oral contraceptives is there.
From a health and safety perspective, clearly the answer is to make birth control pills available over the counter. But unfortunately, in this country, decisions about reproductive health care policy tend to be as much, if not more, about politics than science. Already, as we were reminded in last week's interview, emergency contraception has fallen victim to politics and has been put, for no good reason, behind the counter at pharmacies instead of on the shelves. There's exactly 0% chance that conservatives won't start screaming about teenage girls getting birth control pills if any real progress towards getting this done is made. Already, Janice Shaw Krause of Concerned Women for America is trying to scare people by saying, "Any guy who is older and taking advantage of a younger girl could put her on the pill." In reality, men that are interested in statutory rape rarely show that kind of interest or concern in their victims' health care, which is why girls in that situation already have a higher pregnancy rate than girls with age-appropriate partners. Krause doesn't want to admit it, but she's clearly more interested in punishing the majority of sexually active teenage girls who are having consensual sex with boys their own age than she is in protecting anyone. By the way, since when is it better for a rape victim to get pregnant in the first place? I'd like to welcome Kelly Copeland to the program. Kelly is the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio, and she's here today to talk about a couple of victories in that state and what we can learn from them. Welcome to RealityCast, Kelly.
Great. Thank you for having me.
So, Ohio had a couple of bad bills coming up that have died out. Let's take them one at a time. Some Ohio legislators were hoping to be the next state to pass a bill defunding Planned Parenthood and other family planning centers, but the Senate president announced that the bill would not be up for a vote. How exactly was that bill going to defund Planned Parenthood?
Well, what it would have done is it would have changed the way that the state distributes federal family planning dollars. It would say that instead of the proposal that provided the most care for the most people in need, instead of those proposals being the ones that are funded, they would create a hierarchy of priorities that would first include governmental health agencies like county health departments, some of whom don't do family planning services at all, and make those a top priority and make family planning centers like Planned Parenthood and other standalone centers the last in line, therefore making it highly unlikely that they would qualify for funding. And one of, aside from the obvious problem of that, which is that, you know, a service would be interrupted for patients who rely on Planned Parenthood and other family planning providers, it's actually even more serious than that because our research showed that at least 13 counties in the state were at risk of losing family planning dollars for low-income women altogether.
It's interesting because, like, a lot of other states that were doing that kind of defunding were going at it a different way. They were basically, like, just saying that Planned Parenthood or family planning centers that were pro-choice or had abortion services wouldn't get contraception subsidies. But this was a bit different. Was that something that they were trying to do for a reason?
I think there was a legal calculation there. I think they've looked at how those other attacks on Planned Parenthood and other family planning providers have played out on the courts, and I think that they were looking for another way to try to skin that cat.
But the bill basically died in committee, it looks like. It was the Senate president said that they couldn't bring it to a vote. How did you guys kill it off? Like, why did it die off?
Well, I think there were a number of factors. And it never actually got a floor vote in the House either. It came out of the House committee here during lame duck session, and then the Senate president, as you said, announced that it would not come to the floor in his legislative body. And I think that was in direct response to the enormous amount of grassroots political pressure that pro-choice Ohioans put to bear on the legislature and on Governor Kasich, who has tried to remain behind the scenes on this, but ultimately may be the only one who in the future will be able to block these sorts of attacks. Over 300,000 pro-choice Ohioans contacted their legislators and said, enough's enough. Didn't you hear us on Tuesday, November 6th, you know, we've had it with these attacks on women's health care. And I think that what we've seen here in lame duck with Senator Niehaus refusing to bring this bill for a vote is directly related to that. And he also acknowledged in comments to reporters that Planned Parenthood provides meaningful services to women who may not be able to get those elsewhere. So I also think that the policy arguments we made about concerns for women's access to health care made a difference, at least to that senator.
It's interesting because both in this interview and on your web and your press releases, you emphasize the lame duck nature of this particular state Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that that's like such an important deal? Is the November elections? Do the November elections really suggest that this is that the voters have rejected this kind of legislation?
Yes, and you know, historically in Ohio, the period when the legislature is in session after an election but before they adjourn for the year has been a very dangerous time for women's reproductive health. That seems to be their favorite time of the year to pass restrictions on women's health care. So, you know, that's the one reason we've focused on it as lame duck. But also because, as you noted, in this election, Ohio voters were very clear. Exit polls showed that the majority of Ohioans are pro-choice. They support access to abortion care, and even by more strongly to family planning and contraceptive services. And when you look at how Ohio voters responded statewide to the campaigns of President Obama and Governor Romney, and even in the U.S. Senate race between Senator Sherrod Brown and his challenger, Treasurer Josh Mandel, overwhelmingly, you know, voters supported the pro-choice candidates. The only anti-choice candidates who were reelected were really the ones in gerrymandered districts. So, you know, there's a real sense here in the state that the legislature, who sits in these little safe gerrymandered districts, is kind of out of touch with what happened on November 6th. That I think there's a bit of denial there for some of them because they didn't face the electorate as it truly is. They faced an electorate as they had carved it out.
So there was another bill that's been getting a lot of national attention because it keeps coming up over and over again in committee in the House. There's been various attempts to bring it forward. It's called the Heartbeat Bill, the so-called Heartbeat Bill. Can you kind of talk about this Heartbeat Bill and what it does?
Yeah, absolutely. We prefer to refer to it as the Heartless Bill because it's an effective ban on abortion care in the state with only a very narrow exception to save the life of the woman. And, you know, it isn't designed to be a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade and to limit abortion care, not just for women in Ohio, but across the country. It would be the most restrictive abortion regulation or restriction in the country if it were to pass. and we've been battling this for 2 years now. It passed the Ohio House by a narrow margin in June of 2011, and we've been fighting it in the Senate ever since.
And it's interesting to me because, like, it seems like it's so obviously illegal and so obviously against Roe versus Wade. Why do they think, I mean, because it's basically banning almost all abortions. Why do they think that it somehow doesn't violate Roe versus Wade?
I think they don't care. I think that they have the policy that they would like to have. And as supporters of the Heartless Bill put it, you know, the Supreme Court won't rule on something that you don't bring to them. And so they want to bring the question yet again to the Supreme Court to see if they can get their way. And, you know, their ultimate goal is to, you know, outlaw all abortions here in Ohio and across the country. And, you know, as we come up on the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, some in the anti-choice movement are becoming very impatient.
So why did this, since it passed the House, why did this bill die in the Senate? Why is it not even going to go to a floor vote in the Senate?
Well, I think a number of factors. Certainly there has been an outcry from pro-choice Ohioans and also from the medical community. A hearing about a year ago, just a cavalcade of doctors showed up and testified about how dangerous this legislation was, and that doctors who are in residence, because of the restrictions that were already passed this legislative session, are refusing to remain in Ohio to practice medicine. They're going to other states. And that if this legislation were passed, that would be even worse. And, you know, that's of grave concern to Ohio women because we already have a shortage of OBGYNs. So, you know, I think that was definitely a factor. I think another issue is that the anti-choice community was divided on this legislation, at least up until this week. Ohio Right to Life opposed the bill because they didn't believe that the Supreme Court would use it to knock down Roe versus Wade, and in fact it would uphold Roe versus Wade and strengthen that as a precedent. So, you know, that division has also been a major factor.
So obviously anti-choicers across the country intend to push for similar laws as the ones that have been killed in Ohio, especially defunding family planning in other states. What lessons can those pro-choicers in various states learn from the victories in Ohio to help beat back similar legislation?
Well, I would really encourage pro-choice activists to be loud, to bombard their legislatures. You know, you've got to shut down their email servers. You have to, you know, fill up their voicemail boxes and their fax machines and really be as loud as you possibly can. I think that's number one. Because in Ohio, we don't have the votes in the legislature and we don't have a pro-choice governor. And yet, for the second time in 6 years, we believe that we'll be able to shut down an effective ban on abortion using public pressure. I think that the one thing that most of these politicians care more about than anything is their own political futures. And we really have to make it just politically untenable for these politicians to assault women's health care like this. And I think that's the thing that is the most effective. Also, you know, definitely having these policy discussions, you know, with these legislators. You know, some of them in our state really have responded to that, to the notion that we will lose talented doctors because of this sort of legislation, that it will decrease the options of care for all women because there will be fewer OBGYNs. You know, I think for us, those were the two things that were the most helpful. And if you can't exploit any divisions between your opponents, by all means, do so.
My guest today has been Kelly Copeland of NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio. You can visit their website at prochoiceohio.org. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Kelly.
Thank you for having me and for all the work you do to get the word out about these important issues.
I'm an on-again, off-again fan of the show Parks and Recreation. It used to be my favorite show on TV, but in the past couple of years, they've laid off the more satirical stuff they used to do and have drifted towards more interpersonal, gentle comedy that isn't as funny. But when they return to their roots as a show that uses the politics of small town government as a conduit for sharp political satire, they can be really funny again. So it was with this season's episode, Sex Education, which definitely skewered the mindless prudery of the anti-choice movement, as well as sent up the way that they get their hooks into people, even as their attitudes have no relationship to the way people actually live their lives. Basically, the problems start when the city government decides to address an STD breakout in a surprising community.
Great news! Lots of old people have chlamydia.
Woo!
Seniors in Pawnee have a lot of time on their hands, and what they're doing with that time is going at it hard, old people style. A lot of them haven't had proper sex education, and as a result, STDs are having a field day. It's amazing what a few old guys can do with a little bit of charm and a lot of crabs.
This is based on a real-life phenomenon where the combination of the rise of retirement communities and the invention of Viagra has created a lot more sexual opportunities for seniors. On the whole, this is really great news, because old people deserve to have fun and pleasure as much as everyone else. But they don't have pregnancy concerns, so a lot of them don't think that they need to use protection. And voila! These kind of outbreaks actually happen, and by and large, the sexual health community believes that the best approach is the one that Amy Poehler's character Leslie Knope proposes here. Simple sex education, and providing condoms in places where seniors socialize. But when Leslie and her colleagues actually try to implement the plan, they run into trouble. The city manager comes in and shuts them down, and is followed by a couple of angry anti-choice nuts who found out about the program and freaked out.
This that's happening here is not allowed.
We at the Society for Family Stability Foundation object to this smut being taught. It's against Pawnee's abstinence-only sex education law.
That's only for schools.
Actually, it's not. The way the bill is drafted prohibits any government employee from teaching anything but abstinence citywide.
Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome.
If we allow this filth to be taught to our seniors, the next thing you know, it'll be in our high schools, then our kindergartens, and before you know it, we have babies in thong underwear. Is that what you want?
Yes, that's what I want.
It all sounds ridiculous, but is real life any different? I mean, this is the same kind of mentality that is leading to various state legislatures to try to shut down Planned Parenthood on the same grounds that it has this kind of abstract contaminating power that infects the entire community. What I liked about this is that by swapping out elderly people for children, you can see how ridiculous the anti-choice argument is. Teenagers and seniors are very much alike in that most of us know that they are having sex, but their age makes us blanch at it, and we don't much like to think about it. Anti-choicers are only too happy to harness our discomfort to serve their general anti-sex ends that hurt us all. But our discomfort is not as important as their right to control their own bodies and make their own decisions and be educated to do so in a way that is best for them. But what really made this episode such brilliant satire was how they sent up the media's unwillingness or inability to expose anti-choicers for who they are, in part because we're all so afraid of talking about sex, and in part because it's easier to cast judgment on others than deal honestly with their needs and desires.
Strongly believe in teaching and practicing abstinence.
We all have some crazy urges from time to time, but you just can't act on them. You have to bury them way down deep inside. You have to say, get out of here, you crazy urges. You are not welcome in this brain of mine.
There are some statistics that I'd like to share with you now, and they are numbers. Some 85% of Pawnee residents support abstinence-only education.
And the other 15% are perverts. JK, you guys.
And 100% of Pawneans are Purdvert. That's the name I call fans of this show, based on the fact that my name is Purd.
Genius. Sending up the way that journalists often interview people without questioning their base assumptions? It is true that conservatives take it as a given that suppressing your desires is a good thing, and are rarely asked to explain why that is exactly. By making the people they're scolding and trying to control older than themselves, the show draws home how ridiculous it is for random moral scolds to substitute their judgment for yours when it comes to sexual decision-making. Why are they the authority? Just because they say they are? But instead of asking these questions, the host just changes the topic. I also liked how he brought out a poll and immediately the 15% who want comprehensive sex education are characterized as perverts. This is a classic right-wing technique for deflecting hard questions about their backwards policies. If you question them or refer to the facts about health, they try to turn it around on you and shame you into silence. That's exactly what happened to Sandra Fluck, for instance. She spoke out about contraception access and was met with a sea of conservatives calling her a slut. Same thing. The show was brave enough to deal honestly with the fact that overcoming these obstacles isn't easy. The seniors demand real education and condoms, and Leslie cracks and gives it to them. She gets censured by the mayor and finds out she's got no real choice but to campaign hard against the abstinence-only law. The moral is that these things can't be fixed in one big swoop, and only by doing the long, hard political work can we hope to change it. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, sad, sad Bill O'Reilly edition. O'Reilly is deeply concerned about the mental health of his fellow Americans. Well, some of them anyway.
Many Americans are depressed because traditional America seems to be disappearing.
Of course, traditional America itself left a lot of people, especially women, depressed. Women forced to give birth against their will, especially if they were then forced to give up their babies, often suffered depression. Women who weren't allowed to work because their husbands wanted them to have traditional family structures. And of course, gays who were banned from marriage and society because of tradition suffered high rates of mental illness for it. But hey, some people have a sad because they can't oppress others quite like they used to. And Bill O'Reilly's definitely more concerned about them than all the people whose mental health is adversely affected by being relegated to second-class status.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.